Good morning and welcome. It's day zero, week one of the 2025 legislative session. This is the Florida League of Cities weekly session phone call. Thank you for joining us. For those that are new to the call-in, we start the call with each of the lobbyists going around the horn talking about big bills that are moving this week, key intel, and any data requests that we may have from you, our members, so that we can be effective at the Capitol. Once the lobbyists have shared their updates, we'll open the call for questions. If you'd like to ask a question at that point in time, you'll press star 9 on your phone. As a reminder, this call is being recorded, and we will send an email out this afternoon with a summary of the call as well as a link to the call's recording. Please note, it's not possible to cover every single bill that's been filed during this 30-minute call-in, but if you'd like a comprehensive list of bills that have been filed that the league is actively monitoring, go to flcities.com, click on legislative bill summaries under the advocacy tab. All right, as I mentioned earlier, it is day zero, week one, the day before the start of the 2025 legislative session. It's been a calendar year almost since our last Monday morning call. Tomorrow's session starts. Of note, things you'll want to be watching. You have the governor that will deliver a speech, as well as the Senate president and the Speaker of the House. Many of these folks operate or live their lives under begin with the end in mind. And so those speeches are a good telegraph, I think, of big issues that will come during session or problems that each of those leaders wants to tackle. So be paying attention to what they talk about in their opening day speeches. Other things of note, the Senate is currently on a 72-hour agenda notice deadline. So that means we already know up to Wednesday legislative committee agendas in the Senate. The House, on the other hand, is on a 48-hour agenda notice. So what that really means for those listening at home is that we won't know until 5 p.m. today what Wednesday looks like in the House and the committees that are meeting in the House to consider House bills. So what does that really mean? You need to be paying attention to what's happening because we will get late notice when these agendas are released, and it's important to be tuned in so that you can quickly educate your legislators on those bills that are moving. If you think back to our last legislative preview webinar that we did on February 20th, to that point, 897 bills had been filed. Well, the last week and a half has been fast and furious, and we've had an additional 927 bills filed in the last 8 days. So there's 1,824 total bills filed this year after the filing deadline on Friday at 5 p.m. So with that as an intro, I'm going to kick it to Charles Chapman to start us off on the lobbyist recaps of the bills that they're following and big issues where we need your help.
Good morning, everyone. Happy Monday. Just nothing on the agenda this week in terms of bills up in the committee space, but just wanted to anchor for all of you to be mindful of the finance and tax issues that are coming up this session. We have seen a lot of activity on the property tax issue front. For those of you that tuned in on the pre-session webinar, you heard quite extensively about a handful of bills that are looking to propose either severe cuts to property tax revenues or to posture for complete reform, maybe even study complete elimination. All of those bills are in play. We're monitoring them very closely. We definitely need your help, though, to tell the story. There is a very real sentiment in the House, especially amongst the sophomore class. This is not the new ones that just came in. They've been around for maybe a session or two. Those legislators do not like property taxes. I would even dare say to go one step further and say that they really don't understand what property taxes does for local government, how it works, how much money it generates, how you use it. So my request for all of you is to please continue to gather the information on property taxes. What is your millage rate? What is the value per mill? How do you use it? One of the best examples is to compare how much ad valorem or property tax revenue you get and how much you spend in your public safety budgets. Those of you that aren't familiar with that umbrella term, that's your police, fire, and fire rescue, or EMS if you don't have a fire rescue department. That message seems to be resonating with legislators, and we're seeing a lot of open eyes and raised eyebrows as it relates to that storytelling line of logic to show how much money you're making in property tax versus how much you're spending in public safety as an essential service. In the same vein, we are still fighting the good fight of protecting local government revenues. However, there is another local business tax bill that is filed this session. That is House Bill 503 by Representative Botana and Senate Bill 1146 by Senator Trunow. Both of these bills are identical. They seek to place a cap on your revenues for a given year, depending on where you fall in the cycle. It could be fiscal year 24 or fiscal year 25. It also freezes your local business tax rates in place and time, where you can never adjust them for an increase. With those caps, if you were to make more money next year than you do in your base year, so let's say you made $100 last year and you make $102 next year, you have to issue a refund to every business that paid into the local business tax for that $2 above the money you made the previous year, and you have to adjust your rates so you're back to that $100. This bill is extremely labor-intensive. It's overly bureaucratic. It's a mandate, and we need your help to talk about how local business taxes are used, how it benefits the local business community, and what benefits that you're getting back to help the state government to provide regulation assistance for specific industries like cosmetologists, pharmacies, et cetera. So I believe I said 1146. I'm sorry. The actual Senate bill is Senate Bill 1196 by Senator Trunow. So again, we need your help. Learn, get with your CFOs, get with your city managers. Find out how much you're making in property tax and local business tax, how you're using them, and then don't be shy. Reach out to your legislators and tell your story and help us advocate to protect the base for local government revenues. That's it for me today. I'm going to kick it over to David Cruz.
Thank you, Charles, and good morning, everybody. Like Casey mentioned earlier, we don't know the agendas for many of the committees later this week, and so I want to use my time to focus in on what I would consider three high-level priority bills for the League of Cities this session, starting off with the issue of sovereign immunity. This is House Bill 301 by Representative McFarland and Senate Bill 1570 by Senator DeSigley. The bill is titled Suits Against the Government, and this is an issue that is extremely important to all cities. As we had previously reported, this is a bill that is seeking to increase the caps in current statute from $200,000 to $1 million, and from $300,000 to $3 million. This would be extremely important to all cities, like I had mentioned, and certainly detrimental. The House bill has already passed its first committee of reference. That's the House Civil Justice Committee, and now it's awaiting to be heard in its second committee of reference. That's the House Budget Committee. Other parts of the bill that are extremely concerning is there has been critiques from legislators about the claims bill process. And the bill is seeking to allow the settlement and payout of any of claim above the caps, even above these $1 million and $3 million numbers, without the use of a claims bill. We think that's extremely detrimental. We feel the claims bill process has value, and so we would certainly like to maintain the usage of the claims bill process. And then the third provision that is concerning is that it would no longer allow any insurance companies from requiring the passage of a claims bill to pay out an insurance claim. And so we think that would certainly have impact on insurance premiums across the board for all insurers. So the other side is arguing that it has been since 2011, since these caps have gone up. And so they feel it is necessary to adjust these caps for inflation. And certainly there has been critiques from legislators of the claims bill process. Our position has been that we are willing to come to the table and try to meet at a reasonable increase as far as the increase in caps goes. We have been looking at last year's Senate position as the basis for what we think is a reasonable position. That bill last session on the Senate side was seeking to increase the caps from $200,000 to $300,000 and from $300,000 to $500,000. We certainly think that's a much better position than the $1 million, $3 million currently in the bills. With that said, let me move on to another bill that is going to be very important to cities. And this is a bill dealing with CRAs. And it's House Bill 991 by Representative Gio Lombardo and Senate Bill 1242 by Senator McClain. So these are community redevelopment agencies. This is an extremely vital tool that many cities use to revitalize certain areas within their cities. These bills are essentially looking to terminate CRAs. It's the bottom line. Essentially, the bills require all CRAs in Florida to terminate by a date certain that year, that date being September 30th of 2045, or the earlier if your CRA has provisions in its charter to terminate prior to that year. But essentially, all CRAs in Florida would have to terminate. It would also prohibit CRAs, all CRAs in Florida, to stop issuing new debt or having any new projects by October of this year. So by October 2025, you could no longer have any new projects or incur any new debt. Essentially, these bills are looking to posture CRAs in a position where they would start to wind down. And so you would no longer be able to do new projects. You would essentially just be functioning to pay off any outstanding debt as you wind down the CRA for that 2045 deadline. Additionally, these bills would prohibit and ban the creation of any new CRAs in the state of Florida. And so these are bills that the League of Cities is opposed to. I think the other side will be arguing that it is not a good use of taxpayer dollars to have investments going back into these areas. We've seen a lot of government efficiency type arguments and bills being filed. And certainly I think there could be an argument made by the proponents of these bills that from a government efficiency standpoint, there's a better use of these dollars and that they should go back to the taxpayers rather than being used by government entities. And so that's certainly a pair of bills that we'll be working very hard on. And then the last update on an issue that I wanted to bring up this morning is dealing with a pair of growth management bills. We certainly expect there'll be a lot of movement in the growth management arena this session, but these are probably two of the key ones. It's Senate Bill 1118 by Senator McClain and House Bill 1209 by Representative Steele. These bills are titled Land Use and Development Regulations. And these bills are essentially a wish list for developers. It's a comprehensive growth management package that has several unrelated provisions that would all benefit developers at the cost of local control when it relates to new projects. So let me just highlight some of these areas. One, it has provisions dealing with agricultural enclaves and essentially lowering the restrictions on the approval for new development within these enclaves. It requires the administrative approval of development projects within ag enclaves. So that means there would be no public hearing. You would have to approve these projects administratively only. It would override any comprehensive plan prohibitions that you might have for development within these enclaves. Keeping on with the theme of comprehensive plans, it would prohibit cities and counties from adopting any comprehensive plan elements that are optional that have the outcome of restricting any density or intensity. So you would no longer be able to adopt any of those optional plan elements if they end up restricting density and intensity. Additionally, as we're dealing with comprehensive plans, it would now require a supermajority vote if you adopt any comprehensive plan amendment, if the impact of that is to lower density and intensity and essentially increase development restrictions. And then lastly, it would create a lawsuit if you don't adopt a comprehensive plan amendment within 180 days of it being submitted to you by a developer, and it would create a new cause of action for that. This bill also has provisions dealing with impact fees, and I know this continues to be an outstanding issue. We're probably going to see this come up in a couple different bills, but this bill also deals with it, and it essentially says that cities cannot increase impact fees above the statutory caps, even if you have an extraordinary circumstance. And then it defines what that is, and the goal there is to try to limit your ability to increase impact fees. And then you'll see some provisions in these bills dealing with minimum lot sizes and infill redevelopment. Again, all of these provisions will be developer-friendly at the cost of local government control over also authorizing these projects. And so this will be a pretty comprehensive growth management package. It's pretty broad. It's pretty lengthy. We could really use your development staff to start taking a look at this bill and trying to outline what the most egregious of the prohibitions in these bills would be. we could certainly use your help in just going over these two. And again, that's Senate Bill 1118 by Representative Senator McClain and House Bill 1209 by Representative Steele. With that, I'll pass it over to Matt Singer.
Good morning, everyone. I have one bill on the agenda this week and one bill to put on your radar. That first bill is House Bill 209, filed by Representative Snyder. And this bill establishes the State Park Preservation Act, and it's up tomorrow in the House Natural Resources and Disaster Subcommittee. This bill addresses concerns that were raised by the controversial and now withdrawn Great Outdoors Initiative, which proposed adding golf courses, hotels, and other types of recreational infrastructure to a number of state parks. The bill would require the Department of Environmental Protection to engage the public in many different ways, and of note to municipalities to convene an advisory group that includes a local elected official that must include our input whenever large-scale projects are proposed. House Bill 209 is supported by the League and will be heard tomorrow at 4 p.m. in the House Natural Resources and Disasters Subcommittee. It's important to note that the bill has only received two committee references, which means it has a faster track to being heard on the House floor. And the Senate bill, Senate Bill 80, filed by Senator Harrell, has also already made its way through the first committee. Switching gears to emergency management, there's been a lot of conversation on this topic after the very active 2024 hurricane season. The other side has been focused on finding ways to improve the collaboration between cities, counties, and the state. And so a bill that was put pen to paper last week, I want to put on your radar, specifically on local emergency management, is Senate Bill 180, filed by Senator DeSigley. And this bill aims to mandate several things regarding post-storm permitting, debris hauling, and a lot more. I'd like your feedback on identifying the most harmful provisions from this bill, and I'm happy to share a detailed summary after the call. Again, on this one, time is of the essence. While it was filed last week, it was quickly referred to two committees in the Senate, meaning it can also be fast-tracked to the Senate floor. And with that, I'm happy to pass it to Rebecca.
Thank you, Matt. Good morning, everybody. Rebecca O'Hara here. I don't have any bills to tell you about that are on a committee agenda for this week yet, so I'm going to talk to you about several bills that I know are of great concern to a lot of you that have been filed, some of which may be heard as early as Wednesday of this week when we see the agendas come out. The first two bills I'm going to talk about are Senate Bill 1704 by Senator Kalatayud and House Bill 1523 by Representative Busada Cabrera. These bills deal with enterprise fund transfers for water, sewer, gas, and electric municipal utilities. So what the bills do is they impose a 10% cap on the amount of funds that may be transferred from a utilities enterprise fund to the municipality's general fund. The bills also eliminate the 25% automatic authorized surcharge for water and wastewater utilities that serve extraterritorial customers. These utilities can still impose a separately derived rate or fee or charge for those extraterritorial customers, but that amount cannot exceed 25% greater than what you're charging your customers inside the boundaries for those water and wastewater charges. So no more 25% surcharge off the top, a 10% cap. The bills also impose new public hearing requirements for cities that serve extraterritorial customers with any of these utility services, either at the time you enter an interlocal agreement for the provision of those services or you amend that interlocal agreement. It also requires an annual meeting with the public in the area outside of your city for those customers that you serve on an annual basis, and it requires annual reports to the Public Service Commission. So those are the two water, wastewater, electric, and gas bills. The other two bills I'm going to talk to you about today, sorry, there are four bills, all deal with housing, affordable housing specifically. The first two bills I'm going to talk about deal with housing tax policy. These bills are House Bill 923 by Representative Vicky Lopez and Senate Bill 1594 by Senator McClain. What these bills do is they amend several of the existing property tax exemptions that were approved in the last 2 years under the Live Local Act. The one that's most important to most of you probably is the middle market property tax exemption, which allows you to opt out. This bill, for all of the tax exemption, it expands eligibility for the exemption from under current law. To be eligible, a development must provide 70 plus affordable units to be eligible. This bill reduces the qualifications for all of those tax exemptions for a development that provides only one affordable unit. The tax exemption is tied to the affordable unit. And with regard to the opt-out provision, it makes it more difficult for municipalities to opt out of this exemption. And the way it does that is, under current law, the opt-out is derived from whether or not you have a shortage of affordable housing in your area, according to an annual report written by the Schimberg Center for Housing Studies. The bill now requires your opt-out eligibility to be based on the past 3 years of Schimberg reports. So they're looking at whether or not you are eligible over that three-year period in order to exercise the opt-out in any given year. The other thing that you would have to do in order to opt out is to conduct your own local housing needs assessments and hold an additional public hearing for this. So that's the tax policy side of the affordable housing equation. This is a very short summary. If you have an interest in this issue, I would urge you to look at the bill summaries that are on our website and look for these bills, House Bill 923 and Senate Bill 1594, if you're interested in this tax policy change. On the land use policy side, as it relates to affordable housing, we have Senate Bill 1730 by Senator Kalatayud and House Bill 943 by Representative Vicky Lopez. I'm going to start with Representative Lopez's bill first, because the bills are quite different. House Bill 943, Representative Lopez's bill, could be heard as early as Wednesday in the House Agriculture, Housing, and Tourism Subcommittee. This bill imposes significant and substantial changes to the Live Local Act. I can't get into all of those changes now, so I'm going to hit the highlights. But the main thing that this bill does is that it requires local governments to allow religious institutions to build affordable housing on their property without needing any sort of zoning or land use change. There are lots and lots of amendments to the Live Local Act land use housing mandate, including revisions to the definition of commercial use, industrial use, and areas zoned for mixed use. The definition has been changed so much for areas that are designated as mixed use that the effect will be to allow a Live Local Act project to be built in any zoning district within any county or any city, including single family. The bill extends the application of eligibility for Live Local Act projects to any planned unit development. And it also prohibits local governments from either directly or indirectly limiting the density, height, floor area ratio, or maximum lot size allowed by statute for a Live Local Act project. In addition, the bill prohibits any moratorium that have the effect of limiting a Live Local Act project. The bill creates several different causes of actions for developers against local governments. One cause of action would be for a developer aggrieved by a local government's action under the Live Local Act. And if the developer prevails, they get automatic attorney's fees and costs not to exceed $100,000. Another cause of action created by the bill would occur if a developer or if a local government enacts a moratorium that has the ability of limit or has the effect of limiting someone's ability to proceed under the Live Local Act, again, with automatic attorney's fees and costs not to exceed $100,000. The bill also legalizes accessory dwelling units in all areas zoned for single-family housing and imposes restrictions on what a local government can require of somebody that is constructing an accessory dwelling unit. It reduces impact fees by 20% for all affordable housing developments, and it includes a lot of the provisions that David mentioned that are included in some of those growth management bills. The second half of this Live Local Bill, 943, also has substantial changes to the Growth Management Act, some of which are included in the bills that David mentioned. But another thing that the bill does with respect to the Growth Management Act is it changes the definition of urban service area, and it expands it to essentially mean that an urban service area is any area that could conceivably be served by public services or facilities over a 20-year period. Turning to the Senate land use policy on with respect to the Live Local Act is Senate Bill 1730. As I mentioned, this bill is different than the House companion bill. The Senate is taking a much more judicious approach to amendments to the Live Local Act. The main takeaways for this bill are, number one, it allows local governments to continue to impose development moratoria so long as they do not exceed 90 days. It also requires the local government that is imposing a moratorium to do a housing needs assessment prior to adopting the moratorium. And then it also provides a cause of action against the local government for if the local government violates the provisions of this statute as it relates to development moratoria. The bill also makes some changes to the administrative approval process for Live Local Act projects. For example, it prohibits the local governing body from having a public hearing with respect to a Live Local Act project. It prohibits the use of any quasi-judicial review board or body, and it prohibits any other additional review by other local government development review bodies. So those are some of the additional changes in the Senate bill. The Senate bill does also change some of the types of property that are eligible for Live Local, including an extension of eligibility to any flexibly zoned property zoning districts, such as a planned unit development district. So those are the two housing policy bills as it relates to affordable housing. Again, that's Senate Bill 1730 and House Bill 943. And just like with the tax policy bill, these bills are quite lengthy. I've only hit the highlights. I would encourage you to look at the bill summary that's included on our bill summary webpage on our website. And most importantly, please direct your professional staff to review these bills and provide you some feedback as to how they'll specifically impact your city, and be ready when these bills are scheduled and agended for a committee hearing. This could be as early as Wednesday in the House subcommittee. Thank you. With that, I'm going to turn this back over to Casey Cook.
Thank you, Rebecca. And I think you hit on a really good point there in that, you know, these bills are long. We need your subject matter experts to look at them, get us, you know, your comments. And that really helps us be better. The more data, the more local stories that we hear from you, the better we can be. We can take the sharpest arguments in to our meetings with legislators. I'm filling in for Sam today. And so I have three bills I want to update you on, you know, within the municipal operations bucket. The first is a priority of the Senate president. That's Senate Bill 110. And House Bill 1427. The Senate sponsor is Senator Corey Simon. The House sponsor is Representative Griff Griffiths. These bills are aimed at revitalizing rural communities, many of which are defined as fiscally constrained counties. If you are a city within a fiscally constrained county, you should review these bills because I think there's a lot of good stuff in there and new grants being created to try to revitalize some of our rural communities. So that is one, if you are a city located within a fiscally constrained county, that I would certainly be paying attention to. And there's some potential opportunities for new grants within that bill that could help take your community to the next level. The second bill is Senate Bill 1416. This is a bill titled Municipal Elections. It's by Senator Nick DeSigley. This bill, and it's been a while since we fought this fight, but I'll classify this as a zombie that took a little sleep, but it's back 6 years, 7 years later from the last time we fought it. This is a bill that would essentially preempt municipal election dates and force cities to fall in line with the state election process. Notably, your election dates are approved in your charter by the voters, and this bill is now stepping in and saying you have to use the same schedule as the state, show up on the primary ballot in August, the general ballot in November. And we all know that cities across the state, have elections in all different months of the year, and that's based on feedback from the citizens in your community, in some cases, traditions that have gone on for the last 60 or 70 years. So this bill has been filed by Senator DeSigley. I expect arguments from the other side to talk about the cost savings of not having to have your own election. Probably, I would suspect an argument that the regular primary and general elections have greater voter turnout than municipal elections in other dates. But we ultimately believe that your charter was approved by the voters. In your charter, you determine the best time to have an election for your community, and that the state shouldn't try to solve mythical problems. We think that this is a solution in search of a problem. And so we are opposed to that bill. The final update I have for you is on the short-term rental front. Interestingly enough, this year is the first year where we haven't seen any short-term rental bills filed to date. Now, we're not out of the woods yet. They could still run a short-term rental bill as a proposed committee bill. They have different rules than member-filed bills. So that possibility is still out there. And the other possibility is that there are some bills that open Chapter 509, which is where the short-term rental rules and regs are currently housed, and there could be amendment attempts along the way. So for those listening at home that care about the short-term rental issue, you'll need to stay tuned, and we'll try to update you as soon as we hear rumors or see any amendment language or proposed committee bills filed on the short-term rental topic. So that is Sam's update. We're going to now transition into the question and answer portion of the call. As a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, you'll press *9. And then when you are acknowledged or recognized and it's your turn to ask the question, please open with your name and the city that you represent. All right, first question of 2025, fire away.
Joe Elliott, City of Wildwood. Just wondering if you have any ideas, thoughts, visibility, or anything else on Senate Bill 700. It's proposed under agriculture. You talk about long bills, 174 pages long. And one of the things that it does that caught my attention was eliminate water fluoridization within municipalities.
Thank you, Commissioner Elliott. Great question. For that question, I am going to kick it over to Matt Singer.
Thank you, Commissioner. And like you said, this is quite a long bill. It touches a couple different policy areas around agriculture. Some sections in there earlier in the bill address electric utility land that has solar farms on agricultural land. This is primarily a county issue. There's also some language there on electric vehicle charging stations in the middle of the bill. And then there is some language in towards the end prohibiting the use of any additives in a public water system, primarily for health benefits. This is what we've expected from the state Surgeon General's actions last fall on the addition of fluoride into public water systems. And so this did make its way into the bill and is also in the House companion of the bill, House Bill 651.
Thank you for the question, Commissioner Elliott. We will certainly keep the group updated on that big Department of Ag package. All right, next question.
Yes, my question is actually on the first topic when they were talking about the first responders and us justifying our property taxes. Governor DeSantis and several years ago authorized cities to consider first responders part of our public works group, which we have in our city, City of Pinellas Park, Sandra Bradbury, mayor. Our city, we have re-emphasized that on a biannual basis to remind people that public works are first responders. So when we're kind of giving this information to them, justifying our property taxes, should we not include that as well? Their salaries and the way that we pay them, just like we do the fire and police.
Mayor Bradbury, that's a great question. This is Casey. I think what I would recommend is separating it into two different pots. You know, unfortunately, many legislators haven't served in local government, so they it is your job to educate them on some of the challenges and benefits of serving in local government. Because they haven't served, they don't understand how city services are funded, largely through property taxes. My recommendation would be to pull your police and fire, or your police or your fire, whichever services you provide. But if you have both, let's just operate under that hypothetical. The total amount that you are spending in your operating budget on providing police and fire services. I think you could also pull that for your public works staff as well. But I think it's important to show your legislators, this is how much comes in from ad valorem, and this is how much goes out instantly to pay for public safety, whether that's police, police and fire, or police, fire, and public works. But what we have seen anecdotally in our meetings with legislators is that when you focus on those first two, police and fire, you get raised eyebrows and folks start to look at the issue differently. And so that's where our recommendation is coming from. They are all big supporters of law enforcement, police and fire. And unfortunately, it's our job to educate them how the salaries of police officers and firefighters are paid. Great question. Next question.
Yes, good morning, everyone. This is your president, Michael C. Blake, the mayor of Great City of Cocoa. I just would like to acknowledge and thank the FLC lobby team for doing a phenomenal job in keeping us abreast of the issues there at Tallahassee. There's two things I would like to say from this. Through education that you all clearly delivered to us, and the stories and impact of these bills that will have this performance against our community, I am thankful for your commitment and dedication. So on behalf of all members that attended today's event this morning, I want to say thank you to participating and doing your civic duty in serving your community. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Mr. President, and especially for your leadership. I know with your leadership and our members' engagement, we will have a successful session. Next question.
Hey, good morning, Casey. Daryl Donato with the Florida Fire Chiefs Association and Town of Jupiter. So I just want to say that, you know, we're very concerned from a public safety perspective, very concerned about the elimination of property taxes as a revenue source, or even the restriction of growth in revenue as one of the proposed bills, limiting it to 2%. I think people that live in local communities all across the state rely on public safety for a quality of life. They want to know when they call 911, they're going to get a police officer, they're going to get a firefighter, they're going to get a paramedic. And all those services aren't free. They cost money. And right now, all those services are paid for almost entirely through ad valorem taxes. And without that, you know, those services can't exist. And I don't see consumption taxes being able to replace ad valorem taxes. But anyways, on behalf of the Florida Fire Chiefs, you know, we're committed to helping the Florida League of Cities on this issue. Whatever resources you need from us to help, we're there. Would love to partner with the Florida Police Chiefs Association on the same matter, because I do think you're right, you're dead on, that public safety really resonates with folks. It is truly a prime factor in their quality of life in local communities, and they don't want to see those services reduced or eliminated.
Chief, great comments per usual. We appreciate you, and we will certainly be working together. You know, everyone hates property taxes until they dial 911 and they need somebody to show up at their doorstep. And, you know, the other comment I would have is that if, I'll save that one for next week so you can stay tuned. But Chief, we appreciate you. And, you know, I think together we can educate many of these legislators and, you know, see some of this bad stuff not happen this year. All right, I think we have one more question, so fire away.
Good morning, Casey. This is Commissioner Curtis Johnson, City of Fort Pierce. And I have a
good morning,
question,
sir.
More of a comment. Good morning. Recently attended my MPO meeting in Orlando and learned of House Bill 567 and Senate Bill 462 and had great concerns about the dissolution of MPOs based on this House Bill 567. As a former chair of the Transportation Department and chair of my TPO here, I wanted to know if the League was aware, if this is on the radar. This is quite concerning to me as we're trying to work with MPO organizations along the Treasure Coast, of course, when it comes to transportation. So that's a general question I would have and would like to know the stance of the League with this or any awareness of it.
Thank you, Commissioner Johnson. Short answer is yes, it's on our radar. I will kick it to Matt Singer to dive a little bit deeper on that one. So Matt, take it away.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. On the front, that is another large package bill. That one does include our committee's priority on EV charging funding the state transportation infrastructure. And so this is a bill that we're going to have to tread lightly on and make it more of a strategic engagement. I did see the section on the MPOs. I haven't heard any concerns from our members, though, so I'd love to get with you after the call and hear your perspective as a former chair of one. Saw the dissolution of it, and it certainly impacts the way local governments make transportation decisions. And so happy to continue that conversation on that section.
Great Thank question. Please, we will keep you updated on that. All right, I'm seeing no more questions in the queue. Closing out the call, I just want to hit on two big themes because you've heard some of them today. The first is there's all sorts of proposals out there that are making life harder for cities and that they are reducing some of the revenues that pay for the critical services that we provide in our communities. On the other side of that equation, there are multiple bills filed that increase our expenses. The best example would be sovereign immunity caps or raising the sovereign immunity caps. And so I think that is a key message to take to legislators to get them to zoom out beyond just their individual proposal, look at the full universe, and look at how all of these bills play together. And the real impact, I think, is that it makes it just that much more challenging to provide the essential public services that we do in cities. And so with your help and your educating of legislators, we will have a successful session, but it's going to take you staying engaged. It's going to take you reading the legislative alerts and responding to the legislative alerts as they come out. That's how we make a difference. That's how we have a successful session. We will see you next Monday morning at 9 a.m. for week two of the legislative session call-in. Thank you all for joining us today. Look for the call summary and the link to this recording in your email boxes later this afternoon. Thank you all. Have a great Monday.